call from mom. Answer it. Call silence.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Thank you. Gentlemen and guns coming.
Hey guys, brand new podcast. I am in London. Let me turn off this other mic. London. I'm sitting with my wife. She will not be talking on this read, but we are sitting together in London. I've got a show tonight at 10:30 at the Bill Murray. To all the London fans who hit me up on Twitter, I apologize. I did not expect to sell any tickets here. I did not expect to do a show. And when I did it, I picked too small of a venue what was probably just above the demand. I think we probably could have sold maybe 300 tickets, maybe 200, but so I apologize. I'm going to come back. I'm coming back to London. I promise you that, because I've had a really great time. I did an amazing podcast today with a guy named Al Murray. I'll be releasing that next week. If you get a chance, go online and watch Al Murray. It's the Pub Landlord Americans. I'm saying that because if I hadn't heard of him until this, then you may not have. And you should watch it before we do this interview, because he is really funny. Watch the one where he breaks down the world. It's one where he's got a big globe in his hand and he breaks down the world. It's fucking funny as shit. And it's we did a 2.5 hour podcast today. Other tour dates. Comedy Off Broadway was last month. Laugh Out Loud San Antonio is my first week back in the States, the 23rd to the 25th. San Antonio for the first time. Felipe Esparza is there that weekend too. I'm not trying to sell tickets for Felipe, but I've got to be honest with you. I'd do a 2-show week that week and go see Felipe too. I'm going to try to hang out with Felipe and do something fun with him. Helium Portland the weekend after that. Those shows are definitely going to sell out. So if you are in Portland, get those tickets now. Calling Sick to Work show in D.C. on the 10th is sold out. It's sold out in a minute, everybody. And I brought that up to my podcast guest today. Not this one. This is a good podcast guest. But the one, whatever, I'm rambling. Richmond Funny Bone that weekend, just Friday, Saturday. So 2 shows Friday, 2 shows Saturday in Richmond. Columbus, Ohio, St. Patty's Day, Call In Sick to Work show. Let it flow. Let it. That's not how the song goes. I'm saying let it flow because we are going to be drinking pretty hard that week. And those tickets, that show sold out last year. It'll sell out again now, so get your tickets for this Columbus St. Patty's Day. Omaha Funny Bone at the end of the month. Wise Guys Salt Lake City. Huntsville. Wild West Comedy Show in Nashville on the 21st, 22nd, and 23rd of April. Calgary, then Detroit. That's when the Detroit show is. It is May 4th. I haven't even set up the Kickstarter. I'll get on it. I have really exciting news. I am in London right now, and waiting in my house are coolers full of Blue Apron. I am so... Leanne just pumped her fist. I'll let Leanne get in on this if you want to talk, Leanne. Hang on. So we've used Blue Apron in the past. I got it through Joe. I heard it on Rogan's podcast, and so I ordered it, and we loved it. The thing I love about Blue Apron is cooking is simple. All you have to do is follow the instructions, use the ingredients, and you can make a fantastic meal. That's how foodnetwork.com works. You go online, you re-download the thing. The thing that sucks is making that list out and going to the grocery store and hoping you didn't forget anything, and then getting home, you're like, God damn it, I didn't get cumin. Well, that's what Blue Apron makes is simple. They give you all your ingredients, all your portion sizes. All their seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. The beef, the chicken, the pork come from responsibly raised animals. Produce is sourced from farms that practice regenerative farming. Listen, they can deliver to 99% of the continental U.S. and 99.5% of food desserts. Because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient before required for each recipe.
It's actually a food desert.
Oh, really?
Not dessert.
Because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of ingredients required for the recipe. They're reducing food waste. I'm a fucking idiot.
But you can follow a recipe like a mofo.
This is why I need Blue Apron.
Exactly.
I'm pumped because I think cooking is a really cool thing to do with your family. I know that Leanne and I, as how we kind of like fell in love, was we would make dinners together.
That's right.
And, you know, the problem with having kids is things get so chaotic that you don't get to have those moments where you guys all make dinner together. And so I am so pumped for when we get home that we're going to get to make dinner together, the whole family.
And, you know, another good thing about Blue Apron is you can specify what you do and don't like. So our kids don't really eat fish. So for us to have fish from Blue Apron doesn't make a lot of sense. So you can say, you know,
one of our kids eats fish.
One of them.
And luckily, that's why they've got the crispy Bramundi. Bramundi?
Yes.
Bramundi. Did I say that right?
Bramundi, yes.
Bramundi with quinoa roasted carrot salad. That's a pile as the salad is.
But the roasted pork with apple, walnut, and farro salad, everybody will eat.
And let me tell you something, Blue Apron. By the way, this is the other great part, is that when I go to Gelson's and I buy groceries and I buy food for our family, I spend a minimum every trip of $100.
Absolutely.
A minimum.
Every time.
Every time I over fucking buy. I don't just buy the amount we need. I buy 10 times more. And the coolest part is you're spending under $10 a person for each delicious meal.
With Blue Apron.
Yes. And here's the other thing that I'm so excited about. They've got this udon noodle soup with miso and a soft-boiled egg. Dude, that is one of my favorite things in the entire world, is when you put a soft-boiled egg on anything. And if you show me, Blue Apron, how to incorporate soft-boiled eggs into recipes, I will be putting soft-boiled eggs with that miso soup dressing on everything. I love soft-boiled eggs. Cashew chicken stir-fry. Look, you know what's cool? Get Blue Apron for a friend. If you have a friend, that's what my sisters got it for my parents, and it changed their freaking lives. They had a brand new kitchen, and they were scared to cook in it because my dad's OCD, and he didn't want to spill anything over there. And so they got him Blue Apron, and what? Okay, yeah. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free. With free shipping, go to blueapron.com/BurtCast. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That is blueapron.com/BurtCast. Blue Apron.
A better way to cook.
A better way to cook! No, I was trying to brand it.
Oh, a better way to cook.
Blue Apron. A better way to cook! I'm hoping they'll, you know, that'll be their stamp. And I'm being serious. When I started incorporating ads into this podcast, I wanted things I use. And you know, I'm on the road a lot. Leanne's got the two girls, two dogs, one cat, three chickens, and this shit fills in perfect into our family. So get it. Try it out. Go to blueapron.com/Bert. And get three meals. Just get them. What the fuck? Just get them. They're free. All right. Today's guest, as I get ready for my show in London tonight, today's guest is a guy that I have known for a very long time. I've known him probably almost 12 years, 10 years. I met him when they were auditioning people for Loveline. And I think we ended up talking about it, but I wasn't auditioning. I was just going in to do the show. And we had such a great time, he asked me to come back the next day. And on that first show, someone called from my class, in my Russia class, and said, hey, can you please get Bert to tell the story about the time he robbed us on the train? And Dr. Drew was blown away. And I told that story for the very, very, very first time ever that evening on Loveline. And he said, come back the next night, and I would please like you to tell that story again. And I came back the next day, and I told it again. And I have since told it on Elliot in the Morning, Cowhead, WDVE, Monsters in the Morning. I told it in very few different places, and then I told it on Joe Rogan, and it had changed. It changed my career. So this man, I believe, is somewhat responsible for that change in motion in my career, and I attribute that to him, and I really do consider him a good friend. And it is a pleasure to have him on my podcast. If you don't know who he is, then quite honestly, you need to crawl out of from under the rock you live in, because he has been a staple of our collective unconscious in this country for the past 30 years, I think. From Celebrity Rehab, from Celebrity Sex Rehab, I think he had one of those, from Loveline, from On Call with Dr. Drew, from his podcast, This Is Life with Bob Forrester, which I did. And that was a great episode, by the way. I had a lot of fun on that. Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for Dr. Drew.
This is podcast.
Hello? All right, let's check. Grab that mic, Drew, would you?
Tell us 1-2, 1-2.
All right, I'll see you, babe. I should probably turn off Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives.
Why?
I'm obsessed with this show.
Really?
Oh, like, yeah, because I'll end up... yeah, I love him. I love him.
Yeah.
He's... You know what he is? He is what you think he is.
In real life.
In real life.
I don't think I've ever met him. Maybe I met him early in his career or something. But yeah, he's exactly what he looks like.
He is what he thinks. Yeah. What, like, every little...
We're talking about Guy Fieri. You want to tell your audience what we're doing?
Yeah, we're talking about Guy Fieri. But I absolutely love him. I did Guy's Grocery Games. Oh. I did it with Lonnie Love and Tammy Pescatelli, and the three of us thought we were going to be judges. We didn't realize we were cooking. And
that's awesome.
It was, you could see it in Lonnie's eyes when she was like, "Oh shit."
Oh,
but
my God.
Lonnie's great. Lonnie and I went to a wedding together as dates and fucking tore it up. You know Lonnie?
Lonnie's my boo. What the fuck are you talking
about?
Serious? You dated my boo? I'm so pissed off. What the hell? She's supposed to take me, man.
Did you see her light up Amy Schumer on cultural appropriation?
No, what happened?
It's really interesting. Well, I didn't know what cultural appropriation was. I had no clue. But I've been guilty of it my entire life. I guess Amy sang this Beyonce song.
Yeah.
She shot a video with it with Goldie Hawn, and black women were pissed because that song meant a lot to black women. I don't know the name of the song.
Would it have been? I understand cultural appropriation, but I always worry. I just want to play by the rules. You know what I mean? Whenever we get in these conversations, I get very curious.
Yeah.
So if she had checked beforehand or talked to somebody,
she actually asked Beyonce, but
right.
That didn't matter.
Oh.
It's the name of the song is maybe Formation or something.
Yeah.
But it is a song that specifically talks to black women.
And is it the way she did it messed it up too?
I guess because she had people of color, but she...
What did Lonnie say?
I don't know, but she started crying. And it was real. And then I ran into Lonnie the very next day. We did Guy's Grocery Games. And she was talking to me about it. And I didn't know what cultural appropriation was. It's so funny. I'm that way too. Like, I kind of... Like, I've been really fascinated by the internet lately and just how many people I feel almost enjoy that Trump's president because it allows them to rage.
Well, I think people have felt sort of walking on eggshells for so long.
Yeah.
You know, that trying to be PC and then being told they're bad, that they are they're now the pendulum swinging now. Now it's coming out.
Oh, it's so crazy. I mean, there's a lot of like... I don't know if this is the right thing, but like I used to follow a lot of feminists because I liked hearing opposing views. And I'm not saying I'm not a feminist.
My daughter's super feminist.
But like I like hearing I like hearing where they're coming from.
Oh, are you super moderate, right?
I'm right. I'm not like Adam and I'm not like Joe. Like I think Joe and Adam know their opinions.
They're right.
Yeah.
I'm super moderate. I can be persuaded of a lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah. I'm on the fence. My whole therapy session last week was about I have a problem with
boundaries,
validation, and I need people to like me. Fucking. And so if you just like, I
have a history of that kind of stuff too, but I don't think that's why I'm so persuadable. I think I'm genuinely like, interested in other people's points of view, and I want to understand them. I want to be a part of them. I want to not co-opt them, but like appreciate them. You know?
I want to get like when you say topple the hierarchy or the patriarchy, I want to know what that means, and I want to know why you feel that. And I go, I'm curious. I think it's also being a comic, you know, you got to whatever opinion you have, then you go, okay, probably there are a lot of people that agree with that. Let me take the other opinion.
Yeah.
And then go, let me look at it from the other side and see if I can work it backwards. But then I don't really do that type of comedy a lot anymore. Mm. I feel like now I just am really just storytelling, like almost to the point where it's like so specifically me that I don't really like political stances. I don't just...
Well, I have a story because I came in here with a head of steam a little bit. I'm reacting to your house.
Yeah.
So I love your wife. I've liked your wife. I'm increasingly like impressed or like her more than where I get to know her. But just now she sent me back in to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And I walked in. I was allowed to walk through your bedroom. I thought, oh, my wife would never allow this. And your bedroom's fine. It looks like a bedroom where somebody lives. You know?
Yeah.
My wife would have had to have like a team of surgeons go in there.
Oh, seriously?
And clean it. But hang on. So now I get to your toilet, which is kind of open. I thought, cool. She lets me like pee right here, but right in the open.
Yeah.
But there's a couple of items there.
Is there a shit in the toilet?
No, it's paper, but not shit. But there was a squatty potty.
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. So I'm like, that's another thing we're done to go on for. And do everybody know what a squatty potty is?
Oh, yeah.
It's a Birkin shit with his knees up in his face.
Oh, it's the best. I love it. It's my favorite thing in the world. It's changed the way I shit.
So anyway, that was there. I thought, then you have one of those electronic like bidets, like those ass squirter things.
It changed my life.
Okay. When that first came around, the first time I ever saw that was at what's now the London Hotel. It was some other, I forget what it was called, the Riga Royal back in the day. Remember that?
Yeah.
London was called the Riga Royal. And they only made those things in Japan.
Yeah, that's where I found them.
That's right. And so we got there, and it was Carol and I 20 years ago, and he made me come down to his room and look at it. Oh. He was like, I have to have this. This changed my life.
It's the greatest thing in the world.
He said, I don't know if you're kind of a hairy person, but he's a super hairy person down in that era.
Yes, yes.
He said before that, it was like trying to take peanut butter out of carpet, by the shag carpet.
No, it's totally true. What would happen was, my thing was I shit my pants a lot.
Because you're drinking? What?
No. Just like I just.
You leak?
No, like I have an obsession right now with hot sauce. And so I'm eating the spiciest hot sauces in the world.
So you're actually getting like irritation.
Oh, yeah. But that just hoses it down.
Yeah.
And then you just pat dry. I'm almost hands-free. I love it. Segura's got one. Tom Segura's got one, too. And he's like, it changed my life. He's got one. He got the next level one where you press a button and the seat comes up for you.
Oh.
And it mists.
Oh.
And so, it just is amazing. But I had him in Japan, and I loved it.
Yeah,
and I was like, I told my wife, I said, the only thing I want out of this house is I want that seat. And she was like,
is that your own personal toilet?
That's my personal toilet.
So she doesn't use that?
No, she uses it. But...
It said Bert.
Let me tell you something. Now the girls are obsessed with it. The girls love it.
What's a bidet?
It's the best.
Yeah. I mean, the Europeans aren't stupid.
Oh, I never could understand the intimate washers. It's like a bidet, but it's just a sink next to the toilet. It doesn't shoot up.
I don't understand that at all. That's if you don't want to take a bath or a shower, you just want to clean your pubic hair or something?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. By the way, I've done that. We were on a cruise with my buddy Cowhead, and they had one in his thing.
Cowhead.
And he goes, what is this?
From
and,
Bubba?
Yeah, how do you know Cowhead?
Because when he was – I've known him since he left Bubba, and I knew
from
him back
in – Bubba. You know right now he's fucking in his car losing his mind. From Bubba?
Well, no, he knows that I know. He was there when I was a guest on that show many, many years ago, and Bubba was the – I mean, and Cowhead was sort of the color guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's been doing it on his own.
And then they
now
started feuding. And
they're going through big feuds right
and
now.
And then Cowhead got mad at me or Mike or something. Mike Catherwood. And I'm like, I got nothing but good feelings for all those guys.
Yeah.
They're only good things.
He does a cruise every year that me and Ralphie go on. Ralphie May. And
I know your friends. I've got to come spend more time with you. I love Ralphie May.
Oh, yeah. He's great.
Were you at the – Kevin and Bean did a thing at the – they do that April Foolishness thing. Yeah. You ever do that?
No, I have not.
He did it at the Shrine, and he killed so badly. It was unbelievable. I talked to him the next day, and he was like, yeah, it's something. The audience really, that side,
he
really goes.
He has the ability to do these is very few comics I know can do it, but just almost like jab jokes that just get you on the ropes. Well,
and then it's almost like he hypnotizes the, like there are waves going through the audience, and he times it just so that the audience just starts, it's like a wave that gets more and more intense.
He was someone that pointed out, sometimes I have a, like, I don't know if it's just base ignorance, like that I think most Americans have, but like once.
But Corolla does that on an individual level. He'll come at you with punches until he has you laughing like on the ground.
Oh,
but he doesn't do it so much with the big audience. He does it with the individual. He'll just keep at you too, until you're just like you're crying for mercy.
He Ralphie did this one bit about having a medium sized dick.
Yeah,
and what a big dick does to women's vaginas. And it was he had me rolling, and he just had joke after joke. He maybe had 10 jokes.
Just punch.
Oh, man. Your pussy's going to look like a horse reaching for a sugar cube's lips. Just
and only the way he says it with that silly accent and stuff. But you're saying like most Americans what?
Ralphie and I were on a flight one time, and he read a whole book in a four-hour flight.
Whoa.
And I was like, how did you do that? And he's like, I like reading. I was like, you didn't strike me as a reader. And he goes, why? Because I'm fat? I was like, yeah, pretty much. Did you know that ever since I lost weight, I stopped farting?
You?
Yeah, like I don't fart anymore, and I don't burp.
Because you're not eating as much. You know,
is that what it
is? Yeah, yeah. When you eat less, your system is less. It's like stress.
Is farting a sign of gaining weight?
No, I think it's more the burden you're putting on your colon, right? The
really?
Bacteria having to grow. Ugh,
I used to fart, like rip farts when I woke up. And
your wife must love that.
she came in the other day. She goes, it smells like breath in here. I was like, oh yeah, it's because I was breathing in here. She's like, it's disgusting. Open up the windows.
It smells like breath.
But she
like in the middle of the night, she'll poke me. Stop breathing.
Do you know what's so funny? I see a very different side of Adam. Not to like go back to this.
Adam Carolla.
It's so funny is that I'm sure you probably see this too, but like. I've had maybe a couple interactions with him, but the one interaction I had with him, he was just the sweetest, kindest guy. Like
yes.
The radio personality
he can
was
be that. Yes, yes. Like, sometimes
we were at his show. He did my podcast, but we did it over there, and I didn't know if he was going to have mangria, and I don't drink and drive, so I took an Uber over, and he was like, "Oh, let me drive you home." Same thing you did. You remember when you drove me home that one time?
Yeah.
And he goes, "Let me drive you home," and I was like, "Oh, I'm like that intimacy freaks me out." I was like, I can't. I didn't say that, but I was like, sure. And then got in the car with him, and he was just the nicest.
Yeah, well, it's funny. He's still gruff and aggressive and has all that stuff about him, but he can. There's a really sweet side to him. And it's funny, his friends Chris and Ray, who are like the guys he always talked about, super aggressive and beat the shit out of him when he was a kid.
Yeah,
literally one time, I literally, this is the what's that high pitched sound? Do you hear that?
No.
Well, good.
Maybe we're having a stroke.
Supersonic hearing. So. I think it's one of the lights or something. But he don't know who these guys are. They like came out of the. They're like in 10th grade. They come out of the bathroom. Chris has crapped into a piece of paper towel.
Yeah,
and they come walking up to Adam and they take and smash it in the side of his head and call and start yelling, "Hey, this guy's a shithead!" And
yeah. Those became his best friends.
No, they were already his best friends at that point. So. That's the kind of guys they were.
Okay.
They said to me, oh, yeah, when he was a kid, he was so sweet and so nice. We took care of that. They're like, we ruined that.
He grew up right around the corner from here.
Right here,
like, he said when we came in, and he goes, hey, I grew up right around here. I said, really? He goes, you mind if we go see my old house? I was like in my head, I was like, yeah, let's do this. And then we went over, and he was like, they turned into a McMansion. But I remember that house.
Oh, I do too. Terrible.
I can't believe he grew up there.
Oh, it was like something like a witch would come out of or something. It's like really like a haunted house.
It really
tiny
was.
Though. Yeah. Had two front doors.
And I think he lived on the porch.
He lived on the porch, yeah.
What an interesting, fascinating guy. What is your feeling about, I was thinking about this weekend. It seems like there's been great strides, especially in like our lifetimes, great strides for women. Like I feel like women have...
I think so. That's why this women's movement march was so sort of confusing to me too. I get confused by these things. Like what I think they're afraid something's going to go wrong. I think that's, it's fear that, you know, they should get more explicit. Like, I'm afraid of Sessions. I'm afraid of Roe v. Wade being rolled back.
Yeah.
I'm afraid of defunding Planned Parenthood. That I can get behind. But when I'm just afraid, it's like,
I didn't understand, like, when they were just like, stop masculinity. And I was like, hold on. My thing that bothers me about that is I go, is anyone like I was going to do this thing with a woman named Anna Heed. She's married to Ira Glass.
Okay.
And we were going to do this project together, nonprofit, where we'd go to schools and I would talk to boys. Because I was like, I bet we could make a lot more strides if you talk to the boys. Because that's who's raping people, is the boys. We need to get the boys to stop.
Yeah.
But and so we started doing it, and then I think things kind of fell apart. But I was like, is anyone talking to boys? Like, I feel like we're making great strides for women, but they're trying to destroy what makes boys.
There is a movement. Oh, yeah, yeah. There's a movement to try to support maleness without aggression and without misogyny. And but there's a lot of stuff out there like that.
There's like real parts of my personality that is like 100% dude.
Yeah.
Like, and I can't, I try to quell it, but I like it. Like, yeah, just parts.
And the problem is that people have to, whenever ideology gets in the way of anything that pushes human beings forward, expect it to ill serve humans. So there's an ideology that, oh, no, that has nothing to do with you, man. Society made you that way. It's like, no, society helped.
Yeah.
But there's a big biological piece. And if you pretend that isn't there, anytime you pretend something doesn't exist, you can't work. You can't work with. You have to be. Mental health is reality on reality's terms, and truth is about reality, and science is about reality. So to pretend, because ideologically it doesn't serve me, it's something's not there. No, you got to deal with it. The question is, what is it? How do you shape it? What are the motivating forces behind it? What is that biology? It should be studied deeply, so we can sort of shape it in ways that are more healthy. That's all, and that's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
That quality you know is there, and your parents probably knew that when you were in the delivery room, because we saw that in our kids too. In the delivery room, we could tell the difference.
Really?
Oh, it's obvious.
Really?
Glaringly obvious. There was a girl, and there were two boys, and the boys were kind of different. One was more dude-ish. I was just there. It was.
Yeah.
And by the time they were in first grade, it was very obvious.
Really. How did you, Leanne's like, you got to ask him three questions.
Okay.
Why did he pick addiction to work with?
Total accident.
Really?
Yeah, complete accident.
Wasn't one of those things like everyone was, like your dad was a doctor too, right?
I was I'm an internist, right? And I was doing, doing intensive care medicine. I was going to be a cardiologist. I was heading straight down that path. And I started moonlighting a psychiatric hospital. I'm like, well, this stuff's interesting and I don't know anything about it, which internists think they know something about. We don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
So I started running the medical services there, and I became an expert in the medical management of psychiatric patients. Well, all the medical problems were down on the drug unit, so I got good at drug withdrawal. And then people were asking me to see more addicts all the time. I knew nothing about addiction treatment.
Really?
I started sort of getting exposed to it and sort of kind of understanding it. And the director of the program where I was working said, I need an assistant just to cover me when I'm gone. No big deal. You know, don't worry. It's no big deal. Then he quit 6 months later. And I had to move into the temporary directorship. I'm like, oh, man. So I spent the next like 5 years really making myself an expert. I enjoyed it. The more I got into it, the more I dug it.
And how old were you at this point?
32 to 35 in that range.
Something like
that.
Had you started Loveline?
Loveline was 1983. I was 24 when we started Loveline.
Oh, for real?
Yeah, and that did motivate me a little bit, interestingly, because whatever I kept hearing about in the radio, I'd sort of focus on in my practice and sort of get good at and then bring it back to the radio, because I knew I just knew these were important. You know, the more I heard about stuff in real time, the more I could tell these were involving important problems for people today.
What was it?
I started with HIV and AIDS. That's what my original motive. That's what motivated me to get in at first.
Really?
I wanted to talk about. No one was talking to young people about AIDS. It wasn't even called AIDS yet. We started talking about using condoms before the term safe sex had been coined.
Really?
Yeah. Because I just knew the. You know, no one was talking to kids about it. Or by kids, I mean anybody under the age of like 28.
Yeah. I had some people from the CDC in Atlanta come out to one of my shows, and I made a joke about I can't remember the joke, but it was a joke about AIDS, and they came up to me, and this guy from the CDC said, "Do you know what we call a straight guy with AIDS?" I said, "What?" And he goes, "A liar." And I went, well, really? Well, and he was like, it doesn't happen, man. Well, it doesn't happen.
It does happen. It just doesn't happen a lot.
And it really does.
Well, here's what I call them. I'd be drug addicts. I used to see a lot of that.
Really?
A lot of that. And it was when we were really had nothing to offer, it was so sad. You have no idea.
But I can't imagine.
I tell somebody every day they were going to die in 6 months, and I was never wrong. This is a third, fourth year medical student. So by the time I was a resident, it was like constant. It was like, ugh.
Oh, my God.
Very sad.
So you were there at the ground floor of AIDS.
I was right in the middle of it. Right in the middle of it.
Like to the point, were you in the group where you're like, everyone's got to wear a mask around them?
No, because we had the opposite. We were like, this is not medically transmitted. It's not transmitted in medical caretakers. So we're not going to do anything. We'll barely even wash our hands. You know, we don't care because we're going to prove that you can't get this thing just being a medical caretaker.
Really?
Then about 2 years later, like, yeah, whoops, we could cover just up
some
bit.
Gloves. Some gloves would be good.
Something here. Remember we had this like this. I'm overstating it, but we had this weird sort of spirit, like, oh, this can't be transmitted this way, so we're not going to be too careful, not going to worry about it. I had some other story to tell you. I saw so many AIDS patients back in the day. God, yeah, I forgot what I was saying.
My buddy Tripp is a cardiologist in Tampa, and he was in New York doing his residency or
fellowship,
whatever. Yeah. And his first day, they were treating a woman, and I guess they were giving her blood or something or whatever, and she freaked out, or taking blood from her, and they have a syringe, freaked out, and it flew out in the air, and it landed in his forearm.
Oh, my God.
And he was like, oh, God, oh, this is a not great way to start.
I had that happen to me with a scalpel once.
Are you serious?
Yeah, and somebody had hepatitis C, and I was like, oh, geez.
Shut the fuck
Thank
up.
God, nothing, yeah.
So
thank God, but for the grace of God, yes, we did accidentally Siri.
That was quite an accident. When I say serious.
Oh.
So then did you have plans of mixing medicine and entertainment early on?
I didn't know what I was doing. I just thought I did it for free for 10 years. I thought I was just doing community service.
What, doing Loveline?
Yeah, one night a week for free. It was fun, different, interesting. I met lots of interesting people. It was just sort of an outlet for me.
Really?
Yeah. And then it was like 5 nights a week. I'm like, oh Jesus, how am I going to do this? And then all of a sudden, a TV guy came around. I was like, oh, what is that? How do you do that? So it's all been sort of this weird exploration for me. It was only about 5 years ago I started doing it like for real.
Really?
Oh yeah. I mean, until when I was doing Life Changers, that daytime TV show, and CNN, and HLN, and I had Let's Stop Your Rehab was going then too, and I was like, okay, you got to look in the mirror. Like, come on, man, it's time to admit this is something you're actually doing. It's a second career. You can back down some of the other stuff, and it's okay. You've done your 30 years of medicine full time. You can crank it down a bit.
That's so crazy.
Yes, that was 2010.
Well, I remember watching Loveline on MTV.
Yeah.
It was what was that, 90?
90s. Oh, late 90s.
Late 90s.
Like 5 years.
Yeah. I remember watching that on
And the reason we did that, they came to there like, I didn't know what they were talking about. I didn't know what a TV show. I didn't know anything. And they would literally do 3 or 4 shows a day and change our clothes, do another one, change. We didn't know. And I said, well, look, only thing I've got is Friday afternoon and Saturday afternoon. Otherwise, if we can't do it there, I just can't do it. I'm too busy.
Because you were doing real medicine.
Medicine all, it's like 16 hours a day.
Oh, wow.
And so they crammed it into Friday and Saturday afternoon. That's something.
This is going to sound silly that I asked this, but like, did the radio show get popular after the TV show?
It was always popular, but when Adam came in because of the TV show, we did the TV pilot. It worked. They brought him over to radio, and that's when it took off on radio.
That was some of the best radio I've ever heard in my entire life. I remember my buddy Lorenzo would take he was a headshot photographer, and he'd drop off his proofs at night, and he would do it when Loveline was on, and he'd just drive around the city and listen.
I got to know Corolla because I would time my nursing home rounds on the weekend. He had a shift on Saturday, and I knew when his breaks were, and so I'd make sure I was driving between nursing homes during the shift to
hear
his breaks. And then he was on the show once as Mr. Burcham.
Yeah.
And still we barely knew each other. And then all of a sudden they were like, we're doing this TV show. Who do you want to do it with? I'm like, I have no idea. What are you talking? How do I know?
Yeah.
Leave me alone. And then I thought, God, I bet that Corolla guy could do it. I bet he knows what he's doing with
How
it.
How fucking bizarre is that? What was the point? Like, this is a Bert question.
Yeah.
What was the point where you're like I'm always concerned with, money. But more on like one of my questions to Adam was like, when you lost the job on terrestrial radio, were you freaked out about money? And he was like, oh, fuck, yeah. But like, you have three kids, you've been doing medicine. Was there a point where you're like, we can up our lifestyle because we've got two incomes from two different jobs? And then was there a point where you were like, well, shit, like, what are we going to do next? Like, do you ever get worried about that?
Constantly.
Really?
Well, I'm a catastrophizer.
For real?
Oh, terrible.
Oh, see, I'm that way horribly.
Like that crazy big house you saw us in?
Yeah.
That got bought by a sort of a webcom. I never would have done that. We lived in a house significantly smaller than you're living in forever.
Really?
In Glendale. And we had a web comp, and the president of web comp goes, you got to move, we need you in something, you know, move over here. I'm like, all right. And
what do you mean you had a web company?
I had a doctor.com was one of those go-go web companies in the late 90s, early 2000s. And the web company bought that house.
Hold on. You started a web company.
Yeah.
And it was
drdrew.com.
Drdrew.com.
I've gained it back since. But then it was one of those highly funded big operations.
Oh,
really? For a few years, yeah.
Shut up.
Crazy.
How many times have you gotten in bed with your wife and been like, this could be a game changer?
Like
something like that, like where you're like,
oh, never.
Never?
No. I just don't get excited about anything because I'm too pessimistic.
Really?
Yeah, that's the way.
I love that house.
My dad was a depression era guy, and he traumatized the shit out of me about, you know, tomorrow, end of the world, for sure. And so whenever I needed clothing, like I grow out of stuff. I mean, this is like four. You can imagine doing this to a four-year-old kid. Leanne, your wife and I were just talking about how parents now, how could they do this to kids? It's so weird. But
yeah.
But I remember like being 4 years old, and I needed a new pair of shoes. Like the shoes were just done, and he's like, all right, we'll get your shoes. Go get them. But when you come home, I'm not going to be here. I'll be at the poorhouse. So come wave to me. I'll be there. You can still wave to me through the window. You can wave to the window to me at the poorhouse. You can wave there. I can see you, but I can't talk to you. So no big deal. Get the shoes. I mean, this went on for my entire life.
So was there
as a four-year-old, I was like, I envisioned this place where I was going to go. I mean, I was so flipped out. So I'm always catastrophe.
My dad's big statement was, we're just trying to make ends meet.
Oh yeah,
I thought that was a cut of meat. I thought it was the very tail
making
end,
meat.
And I was like, I've never even eaten ends meet. And my dad was like, oh, we're just trying to make ends meet. And I was like, right. You never have made it. I've never had it once.
Yeah.
But my dad.
I think that's what drilled my workaholism.
Do you think you're a workaholic?
Oh.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, define workaholics. I think I'm a workaholic.
Well, I would, before therapy, I would work so much that I would have dread, like almost every day when I woke up. Because I would never sleep enough. And I just never had anything except work. Nothing. Not sleep, no nothing. I couldn't cry. I didn't have time to take a pee.
Really?
It was weird. Yeah, and that went on for years and years and years and years. And that was on weekends and stuff, too.
Really?
Yeah.
And you just couldn't put it down?
There were many reasons for it. I mean, I was so invested in being the perfect doctor, available to anybody, anytime, anywhere. You call on me, man, I'll be there. And that's what I did, no matter
really?
What.
It's interesting that in a job of addiction that you kind of...
Well, that came later. The addiction, you know, once I got much more involved in psychiatry, I was involved in my own therapy then.
Really?
I couldn't do the work without clearing my own stuff up. And I don't think I effectively would do it unless I had really, you know, taken care of myself. And that all settled down.
Really?
Yeah.
When did you get in therapy?
You know, my kids were one. They're 24 now, so 23 years ago. And I went for 11 years.
Really? When do you know when you're done with therapy?
Well, funny. I think I did 5 years of really intensive, like where I got a lot done. And then I did another like 3 years where I was just sort of showing up because I thought it was like, I got to work out every day. I got to go to my therapy.
Yeah.
So I just did it because my therapist kept going like, what are we doing here? What's going on? And finally I went, you know what? I need to leave. And as soon as I said that, I started working again. I started doing more emotional work. And I did it for 2 years and then I left.
Really?
Yeah. So I had like a 2 year closure on the therapy, you know, or maybe 3 year closure. And that was important part of the whole thing.
I feel like,
you know, moving away is, you know, closing it down, moving away, becoming autonomous. I mean, that's that work.
Yeah. I've been in therapy. I had a meltdown working with Travel Channel where I didn't realize it, but I was getting PTSD just from doing like
bear sitting on you,
anything. Yeah. I just had a meltdown. And yeah. Leanne is so grounded. She's like, don't worry, go down to the bar, meet Anna. She's going to have, she worked at Travel Channel at the time. She's like, you guys are going to have a drink and I'm going to get you a flight tomorrow and everything will be squared away. And I got down there, and Anna had a drink for me. She's like, don't worry. We pulled a shoot date. Not going to have to go anywhere. You can go home and see your family. I got on a plane the next day. I got home, and Leanne's like, you got therapy at 2.
Oh.
And I was like,
well,
really?
My wife made me go to therapy, too. That's how I went.
Really?
My kid was having brain – Douglas, I don't know if you met one of those kids, but had brain surgery when he was 1.
What?
Yeah. He had a – it's a long story. I don't want to get into that. But he had brain – and I was – like my anxiety was off the chain, and I was workaholic, and my wife calls me, and she goes, you need to have therapy. And I was – all the while, I've been always been thinking about it, planning, and I go, yeah, I know. I need to go. And she goes, no. You need to go. I was like, stop. The way she said it stopped me in my tracks. I'm like, okay, got it. Right now, put the phone down. I'll call her.
For me, I had 2 things that held me back with therapy. Number one, I thought, okay. I remember I went to one therapist. I had a very public breakup with a friend it was Jay Moore. And he was not being maybe the nicest. It was bothering me. And I couldn't tell my guilt in anything, and I couldn't find my own. And so I went to this therapist, and I felt like saying to him, the first question I asked is, I said, how much is your mortgage? He's like, why does that matter? I go, because I feel like as long as you have a mortgage, I'm going to have problems. Like, I see the two being tied. Like, because I'm in essence paying your mortgage by paying you. So, like, I just want to know how much your mortgage is. He's like, it's inconsequential. And I go, no, because if your mortgage is like 10 grand a month, then I'm going to have problems for a long time. And I was like, but if you have a low mortgage or if you rent, I'm not really that concerned. And I feel like you're really there for me.
In therapy soon.
Yeah. And I was like, he was like, I don't think we'd be a right fit. And I was like, okay. And then Joey Diaz ended up just calling me.
You know, I would have said the same thing.
Yeah. Oh, I was.
Because it's not a good place to start from.
Oh, I'm just so. Oh my God. I had another therapist that I did not go well with, but she was a woman. And I kept thinking, she wasn't that attractive. And I was like, I guarantee you she wants to have sex with me. I was like, that's the way anyone works. Like,
but that's your process. And you should tell her that when that happens.
I did.
Okay, good.
And she was like, I don't want sex with you. And I go, eh. I was like, I bet I'm eye candy to you. Like, I bet I come in and
that's awesome.
she was like, I don't know why that would matter. And I go, I don't know. I mean, I feel like, you know, if I had a hot client that came in.
That's actually good therapy. The fact that you're being so open and honest.
She didn't like it. And then we stopped.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's her stuff then.
Yeah, she didn't like it. She bothered. And I was like, oh, I must have hit a nerve. My therapist now, the other thing I didn't like, is I don't like having to get in a car and go somewhere to therapy.
Yeah.
So I Skype with him. It's awesome.
Really?
Yeah, I love it. I've never even met him. I mean, I just know him on Skype.
It doesn't seem like that. I must tell you that for me, it's me, the kind of therapy I needed to do, I needed a person in close proximity.
Oh, really?
And I needed her. I needed to
You just said her. You needed a her?
Yeah.
Oh, I couldn't mess around with a chick.
So I needed attunement. I needed, you know, proper boundaries and somebody that actually sat and listened deeply, where I could, like, her whole body was listening. And it made me an amazing, helped me work with patients like crazy, because then I could do that for patients.
But does part of you think to yourself, like, to your therapist, hey, man, you're lucky you're getting Dr. Drew? Like,
no. I have low self. I have shitty esteem. No, I have low self-esteem.
Like, how cool if you're Dr. Drew's therapist? Like.
No, she's way too good for that.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, see.
I never even occurred horrible. To me. That never even occurred to me.
Oh, God. Oh, I'm fucking.
I ran into her once out in the world, like five, six years after I finished. And she goes, somebody said you were here. And she goes, you know, I hope the work we did had something to do with the success you have. And I go, dude, there's a whole reason I could do it.
Really?
I go, thank you. I'd sent her, sent her a letter saying thank you. I don't know how you sat through all my bullshit for all those years.
Like, what kind of bullshit? I can't imagine your bullshit. You seem like the most even-keeled guy. My bullshit's real. Like,
would you want to sit through not real bullshit? I wouldn't.
What?
I would like your bullshit. Oh, that sounds interesting to me. But mine does not sound interesting.
Mine's fucking,
well, good.
Crazy. Like,
you need a female, though.
I couldn't deal with a female.
Come on now.
Mm-mm.
That's where the work. That's where the work is.
Did you feel like when I couldn't have a. It's like one of the things that I used.
You're married to the one you're married to.
Oh, God,
She's your therapist.
Oh, she has this book, You're a Badass, and she'll read it to me. She knows I won't read it out loud, and it's all about self-esteem and ego, and then like a fucking jerk. She's reading it, and then I go, I think this guy's gay. And she goes, no, it's a chick. I go, I can't listen to this shit anymore. And she goes, what? I thought this was a dude.
Oh man, you've got to work with one of these.
She was like, are you serious right now? And I go, well, no, I mean, it's just a woman's wants and needs are always going to be different than a man's wants and needs. And she was like, no, they're inherently the same. I was like, no, because like one of the things she said, it was a misnomer. She's like, or maybe you want that hot dude in your yoga class. And I was like, what? And I was like,
he's gay.
I was like, there's no connection whatsoever. But yeah, Leanne's just one of those people that she believes in doing the work.
Well, what are the other things that she wanted? That was one. We now answered one of the questions she wanted you to ask me.
What?
You said there were three she wanted.
Oh, she wants to know how you and Susan met.
Oh, through radio, too. She was like a promotion person there and just was working with the Bikini Girl group that they had there.
Really?
And I had this very intense reaction to her. Well, here's a crazier story. Turns out we had met years before. She was like at the microphone announcing a fashion show. She was running this show. And this friend of mine, after second year medical school, we went down to Orange County and locked ourselves in a room and studied for these called National Merit Boards that we had to take. And it took 2 weeks. We were just killing ourselves, studying our asses off. And like 10 days in, we were like, we're going to kill each other. We got to get out of here. So we went to this bar. There was this fashion show. Here's this woman at the mic. I go, I have to talk to her. I'm not like that. I don't talk to anybody. I just can't.
Really?
I can't walk up to somebody and talk to them. But I was like, I have to. And I, after like stalking her for an hour, finally got in there and said something. She just blew me off horribly. I was like, fuck, let's get out of here. Screw it. So fast forward like 3 years. We met through radio people, and she had a boyfriend then, I didn't realize it was the same person. I had the same reaction where it was like, I can't not do what I'm about to do. And I go, look, I know you have a boyfriend. I would never interfere with anything, but if you should break up, here's my number. Just, I want you to call. Just no big deal if you don't, but here's my number. And she called. And that was that. And then about a year into dating, she had one of these, they have glass tops on your desk.
Yeah, yeah.
And she would slide pictures under there. And I'm looking at this one picture and go, oh, there's that fashion show. Oh, my God. Were you at that fashion show? That? Oh, my God. That was you.
Shut up.
I didn't even know until like a year later. Yeah.
Isn't
that weird?
Now, what were you? Were you like?
And then we were on, off. And then we finally got our shit together.
Really?
Yeah.
This is a weird question to ask. You don't have to answer, but I'm just curious. Were you like, did you have a lot of sexual partners before you met your wife? Were you like a sleep around guy or a monogamous guy?
Not a monogamous guy.
Really?
Not at that point. No, I liked dating. I really liked it. I love you to hate it. I really enjoyed it.
I hated dating.
I liked it.
I like being in a relationship.
Well, I prefer that too, but I actually really enjoyed going out and meeting people and stuff.
And did you guys know that you wanted to have kids, or did you think kids weren't going to be something that you guys wanted to do?
No, we both knew it. But I was, I think I was sort of weirdly, I don't know, it was weird. I had a weird attitude about marriage. I guess I was afraid of it. I sort of felt like, well, you have all this fun, and you get married, and then you die. It's like, you know what I mean? Marriage and then death. And if you marry, of course you have kids. And I always knew I could do that and wanted to do that. But it wasn't like, until she really pushed both, I was weirdly immature that way.
You two are a very interesting couple, because you seem like very different people.
Very different.
Like which really. It was so funny because I said to Leanne, she goes, what do you think Dr. Drew's wife's going to be like? And I was like, oh, probably. I was expecting a surgeon.
No.
Like, I was expecting.
No. I can't stand people like that.
Oh, yeah.
No, I mean, I like them, but I couldn't live with them or anything. No way.
Oh, no,
two,
yeah.
Two of me? Are you kidding?
Oh, it's like Leanne and I are completely opposite.
Yeah.
Like, she's one of those people that, like, she's very matter of fact. Like when I probably told you this, but when we first started dating, I was taking Xanax like crazy, and she just was like, "Oh, you're done.
You're not doing that anymore.
Yeah, you're done.
That's great."
She was one when I fell off that waterfall and I was taking Oxys. She was like,
"No more."
She's like, "You're done," and she threw them out. She could go get a prescription for marijuana if you need it, but you are not taking these anymore. So I was taking them with Valium because that's what they told
me
to
do. So dangerous. So dangerous.
God. Have you seen drugs change, like addictions change, as long as you've been in this? What have been the peaks?
Well,
it was,
you know, I started, it was pot, alcohol, cocaine. I mean, that was the combo. And then meth kicked in.
You remember when meth kicked in South California?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I thought for sure it was because we were treating all the ADHD and ADD with stimulants in childhood.
Really?
I was convinced of it. So I looked at that literature as it evolved very carefully, kept abreast of it. And it was very clear the opposite that had nothing to do with it. I mean, it's really clear in the science that the stimulants up to the age of 18 reduces your risk later. So it was something else. There was something else going on,
really?
Which was just the cheapness, the availability. The cocaine was expensive and, you know, and it just got distributed and people liked it.
Did you have friends and family like around you ever getting addicted?
No, not that I can think of.
Like no one, like no, you never had like a friend call up and go, Drew, Dave, I need you to help my kid.
Into it. Yeah. I still get those all the time.
Really?
Yeah, all the time.
Do people have a hard time partying around you?
Yeah, which I hate because I'm not the – I don't – if people want to use drugs, I don't – you know me. I'm kidding. I'm supposed to be like the narc guy, and I'm not at all. I'm interested in helping people that want to stop who can't.
Yeah.
That's it. That's who I'm interested in helping. Everybody else, I want them to have a good time.
Can you you know what, the opposite of gaydar, do you have like that with alcohol or with addiction? Can you tell you're like, ugh?
Probably alcoholics best.
Really?
Yeah, addicts, addicts BS me. I've been BS by the best.
Oh, you've been?
They're really good at.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah.
God, I love Celebrity Rehab. Fucking loved that show.
It was fun.
Is Steven Adler still around?
Yep. In fact, his mom's coming on my radio show soon.
Really?
Yeah, she put a book out about
it. How's he doing?
Pretty good as far as I hear. Yeah. Really good. Yeah. Compared to what we found. Oh, my God.
That was so heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Because you were just like, man, that was him and Jeff Conway.
Oh, yeah. Jeff killed me. Jeff was.
I don't know what she thinks she's doing.
She's coming into the show.
I'll know.
She's going to join us. Yeah. Jeff, you have no idea what I did with the struggle with Jeff over the. Even long after the show was over. Kept struggling. And my peers killed him. They kept putting him back on opiates. Every time I get him off, they put him back on.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It was terrible. It was so awful.
What does she think she's doing?
I mean, he was so... he goes...
I don't know. No. I don't... Hold on. Jesus Christ.
She has something important.
What? Yes. Oh, he is? Mm-hmm. Oh, fantastic. This is my friend. Okay, goodbye.
What was that she said?
There's a child that I find absolutely hilarious, and he does not do it on purpose.
He's in her class?
He's in her class. They're in a play together.
Oh, how fun.
And this kid makes me howl laughing. But he's just one of those kids. He's just different. He's just
awesome.
And so she came
back. She wanted to make you happy. See, she did.
They were putting him back on opiates?
Oh, yeah.
Why?
Well, he's a drug addict, right? So he'd seek them, and they'd go, oh, your back pain? Oh, yeah, we need another operation, and we need to put you on. He got so strung out, they actually had to put him in a nursing home because he was on such high levels they couldn't safely have him out in the world. It was so crazy.
So what is the math with putting people on opiates? Like,
oh, don't – it's such a long story.
Really?
If people want to blame the drug companies, fine. It was my peers. It was pain management. It was my profession that did it and still doing it. Still doing.
I'm always shocked at how easy it is to get opiates.
Oh, it's ridiculous. And nobody better at it than addicts. They know exactly where to go, what to say. And our job is to figure that out, not to just go, who are we? Who are they asked for? Who am I to say what pain is? You wanted, you know, he needed relief. Like, oh, come on.
Oh, hey, when they say to you, on a scale of 1 to 10, where is this?
Oh, please.
Whoever says it's a 4. Well,
and towards the end of when I was running the treatment center, all we were doing was taking so-called chronic pain patient off opiates, much like Jeff.
Yeah.
And they all the same story. What's yours on a scale of 10? It's a 20. It's a 20.
Yeah.
And we would get them off opiates, no pain treatment other than getting them off the opiates. 2 weeks later, they would not discuss their pain. They would not mention their pain unless you prompted them. And they would always say between 4 and 6.
Really?
Yeah. Just taking them off the opiates. And pain management never did that.
What's the worst opiate out there?
The one you like.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They're all bad of anything.
Because I've always gotten a hydrocodone. That's nothing, right?
That's Vicodin?
Mm-hmm.
What's the other thing? I don't want to talk about opiates.
Okay.
I talked about it so much.
Okay, let's talk about what else
did your wife want? That was two. We got two questions.
Raising children.
Okay, what about them? She would have been so mad if you didn't ask me all three.
I know, yeah. She wanted to know. She wanted to, yeah. Well, she came in and I was
you're on your squatty potty.
I was watching Neil Brennan special, and she just goes, "Hey, I need to talk to you about this interview with Drew." I think she wanted to be in here in it, and I was like, "No." But then, even still, when she came in, I go, "Do you want? Oh no, I got to pick up Georgia."
Yeah,
raising kids because you know we feel like very candidly, my youngest is going to be one of those wild children. the one that you just met.
You mentioned she's like you.
Yeah, and I was like, and she was like, he seems to have very successful children. How did he do it? Did they, like, did your kids ever get drunk and go, Dad, I got drunk? And then you had to, like, what were the, what, like, and especially with the legalization of marijuana, like, I don't know what to do.
Well, it was a little easier because it wasn't legal. But I just said, look, you know, because I'm always telling parents, I, you know, I spent a lot of time in my career where I told parents what to do. They didn't do it, or they did 10% of it, and the kids died. And I saw that, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
I know how to do this. I know it's not pleasant. I'm going to do it. So I said, first of all, I'm sorry, but I don't allow any illegal activities in around my home. Any.
Yeah.
So is it legal to drink at 21? Illegal to drink at 21? Yeah. Oh, well, guess what? You're not drinking then. That's it.
Really?
No big deal. Okay. Are there any other? Do I let you do anything else illegal? Well, speeding, okay. Well, I don't really like that anyway. But, you know, I don't let you do illegal things. And if you have problems with the law, I'm going to make sure the consequences are fully come down on you. I'm not going to rescue you from anything like that. No
really?
Way. So, and then one day, I was sort of made that known for a long time. And then one morning, they were about 14, 15, we were at breakfast, and I just somehow it came up, and I thought, here it goes. I go, look, they'd all been to my unit. They'd all seen what I do. They'd seen it a bunch. And I go, you guys know what I do, and you know I have to, you know, I tell parents all the time what to do, and I've seen some terrible things happen. So, look, I'm sorry for you that I'm your dad, but my experience has taught me that, look, you can do whatever you want. Good. I know you're going to try stuff. But if you drive a drug problem, trust me, I will pack your car with heroin and make sure the cops get you. And I will make sure that you have the – I will talk to that judge, make sure the things come crashing down, fullest possible extent. Yeah, in my head I'm thinking, and make sure they mandate 5 years of treatment and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
blah.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying I'm certainly not going to rescue you and make things better. No way. If you get a problem with the law, it's coming down. It's going to happen. Just
really?
Try me. Then I said – I don't allow anything illegal. So if you do something illegal and you get caught, then it's on you. In fact, I'm sure I'll come get you. You just take care of it. It's your problem. Then I said, God help you if you go to a party where an adult serves you alcohol. Because I swear to fucking Christ, I will show up on the lawn with the sheriffs and have those parents drawn, taken away. And I'll be on the lawn laughing my ass off. Try me. And they're all like, and the comedy was, my son's like, uh-huh. My daughter ate her face in the cereal, didn't even look up.
Really?
And so I'm like, okay, mental note, got my eyes on you.
Yeah.
And God damn it, they didn't get to go to any parties. Nobody, people didn't invite them to parties and things. And
I never understood parents who let their kids drink. That never.
Well, I'd rather they drink here than. But that's
I don't
such
get that.
BS.
I don't
it's
get that.
Stupid parents. They really don't understand. Adolescent brains can't understand. It's okay to do something here, but not here. They if it's okay to do something here, it's okay to do something here too.
Yeah,
that's the way adolescents work. And no, they believe me. They need very firm boundaries, very significant consequences, or it will start to happen. Stuff will happen. And you know, the key thing, once they're in college, it's like, hey, man, it's on you guys. You do whatever you do. But my thing is trying to preserve their brain during development. I mean, it is serious business. That's my job.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry. And it'll be terrible. What a horrible thing to have to do to bring the axe down if they do develop a problem. But I said, look, that's what I tell parents. Like, it's not about you. Your job is to drop the axe. Just drop it and just let it fall. Don't get angry. Do it with peace and love, and boom, let it happen. Because otherwise, you're into a dance. You're in a dance that will go on and on and on.
Yeah,
to be firm. That's all I'm saying.
That was firm.
Be direct. Be clear.
And did it work?
Yeah, it seemed to. I'm sure in college it did stuff, but they're adults then. Essentially, it's like on them. It's like whatever. You know.
That's interesting. What was your dad? Was your dad firm?
No, my parents had no idea what I was doing.
Really?
No idea.
When was the first time you got drunk?
14 or something.
Did you smoke pot growing up?
A little bit. I hated it.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't like it.
I just started liking it again.
I really didn't like it. When I was in college, I lived on a floor with a bunch of guys that smoked a lot of pot. And I kept going, no, I just not. They go, you don't do it right, man. Because when people are marijuana addicts, they love it. You know, they just love it. And so the idea that somebody doesn't like it is incomprehensible.
Yeah.
And that's a different biology. It's just a different biological thing. And they're like, no, no, man, we're going to teach you how to do it. Yeah. So they made me smoke a lot for a week. And at the end of that time, I felt terrible and we've liked it less and had trouble concentrating and couldn't do my calculus. I was like, oh my God, I hurt myself with this garbage. So that was it. I was just sort of done with it after that.
I smoked it a couple times when I was like probably 14. And then smoked it one time with my buddy Blake, and I had a full-blown panic attack.
Yep.
And I couldn't enjoy it.
I've seen people have panic attacks that never stop.
What?
People deny this happens. I'm telling you, I've seen it clinically. It's rare, but I've seen it.
Is that the story? Like, you'd hear these horror stories about the guy who did acid one time and never was the same?
Yeah. Well, that guy, yes. There, I've seen stuff like that, too. But those people were already, something was going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always wondered if marijuana could bring on schizophrenia.
There is data if you do a lot of high dose that you can bring on schizophreniform things, maybe schizophrenia, or there's a higher incidence of that sort of maybe being expressed in somebody who might be predisposed.
Yeah.
I think it's more like that.
But it's got to trigger it at the age.
Trigger something, yeah.
The age that it would have been triggered regardless.
Yeah, yeah.
And you might have been prone to it anyway.
That's right.
That panic attack I had when I was 14 was to a point where I was like, I will never smoke this again. And then ended up smoking it again with my buddy Cayman and Sean and Spencer and had another panic attack immediately. And I was like, okay, I'm done. And then I didn't smoke it again for a while.
I'm sure I'd have panic. I'd panic in college and stuff too.
Oh.
And I'm sure I'd have that again.
I want to say no joke that, and I had panic attacks younger than that. I always had panic attacks in my life, but I didn't mess around with weed again until I was in college. And then once I was in college, I would be very like scarce about it. I'd be like a little bit, just a little bit. But I started enjoying it again recently.
Because they have all those different forms of it, you think?
Yeah. And you can go, it's like when you were a kid, you didn't know what you're getting. And so,
yeah, you're buying a lid, man.
Yeah, you're like, and I know for a fact I started smoking it to cope with Travel Channel because I remember it was such a great experience. I'm not shitting on the experience. It was a great set of life experiences, but it was just too much at certain times.
Yeah, I get it.
Where you're like,
TV's intense. They are always drilling for more intensity, more whatever.
Yeah. Did you vote for the passage of legalized marijuana?
I think I did. Yeah, I did.
Do you think it's going to be good? My dad is against it.
Oh, no, I think I abstained. I abstained from that vote because I felt like I shouldn't really take a position on it.
But I was
fine that it went.
Well, yeah.
Well, it was not particularly good in Colorado, and there'll be some bad consequence, and then we'll sort of get our crap back together again.
It would be cool if they could just lower it, lower the dose. They're never going to do that, but lower the dosage so everyone...
People take more. You know it goes.
That's what I'm worried about with my kids is like my daughter asked me about marijuana the other day, and I was like, I guess I'd rather have you smoke marijuana than drink. Because you can die from drinking.
Yeah, but the data on the adolescent brain is really scary.
I don't really. I told her I was like, yeah, I don't know if I'm parenting well because I was like, I don't want you doing anything.
You got Leanne here, relax.
Yeah, I go.
You're fine.
Leanne's like, let's just be honest with them. I go, are you fucking out of your mind?
No. You don't. Well, you have a problem because your brand is about all the stuff you did. Normally, I tell parents don't discuss what you did or didn't do.
Really?
Tell them about what you expect them to do.
Do you ever think about writing a parenting book?
Yeah.
You seem to have done good.
Yeah.
You were hanging out with your kids the other night.
Yeah,
everyone seems well-rounded.
No, they're great. They went to great schools and they're doing interesting stuff. And you know, I just feel lucky. But for the grace of God, I really do feel lucky. But I think, you know, look, I think we have pathologized adolescents and young people.
What's that mean? I don't know what that means.
We made them sick and a problem. And they're, for the most part, good.
Yeah.
If you're good parents, if you're involved, you stay together, you hold a safe unit here for them, you contain them, you love them, you direct and farm with them, it's going to turn out okay.
Yeah.
For the most part. I mean, really, we lived in a weird toxic world where it's scary and bad things can get triggered just by the nature of the chemicals that are around. But you can get on that quick. You know what I mean? You can get on it.
Yeah. I feel like I'm not – it is kind of a weird – especially being a comedian. So you put everything out there on stage.
I know.
And so I mean, it's
a special case. It's almost like being, to me, it's like being a drug addict. Like when people are drug addicts, go, yeah, you tell them everything, but you make them part of the recovery. So I guess I'd say the same thing here. Make sure they get proper treatment and be part of the mental health, whatever services you use. We use lots of mental health services for our kids and family and stuff.
Really?
By the time they were three, we had a behavior specialist because we were like yelling a lot. We're like, what the hell's that? And so we got this behaviorist. Here's what we do. Change our life.
Wait, who's yelling?
We were like, the kids. We have three little toddlers running around. You're yelling.
Yeah.
And we were like, this can't be right. We're yelling too much. And so we went and saw behaviorists. He gave us certain things to do, and it just changed our life fast. It was crazy.
Really?
Yeah. And everyone's had therapists, and you know.
Oh, I think Isla's, Georgia started having panic attacks.
Yeah.
And Leanne got her therapist, and bam. But it's so funny.
It pays dividends. It really pays dividends. So they just, you'll be fine.
A little bit of insight. Like, so what Leanne was doing was saying.
I was actually afraid my kids would go, hey, you farmed out your parenting to all your professional peers. I was afraid of that. We did so much of it. And I was like, no, they haven't said that, thank God. So
no, Georgia was getting panic attacks, and Leanne would just go, honey, just go back in bed and try to count sheep or listen to music. Listen to music or count sheep. And Georgia's like, it's not working. Yeah. And she was like, no, it is. You're not doing it right. And then they went to the therapist, and the therapist was like, oh, that's the worst thing, to tell a child to count sheep.
Yeah, I know.
That's keeping the mind active. Yeah, you need to shut the brain off.
Yeah.
She's like, music is a horrible fucking idea. Do not play music. And because she was playing this music, and Georgia just...
What'd they ever do? Read or something?
I don't know. She's got these... breathing techniques, I guess she does.
Breathing's best. You can get
to George just went to tooth therapy sessions and was like, I think I got it.
Yeah, right? Isn't that great? It's crazy.
I was like, are you kidding me? She looks at me and she's like, Dad, you should take like meditation or something. You said that the other day, transcendental meditation.
Yeah?
No, you were like, you should try that.
Yeah.
Does it work?
I've never tried it, but you know, Stern always talks about it.
Oh, does he?
Yeah. And people swear by it. No, I think we were talking about meditation generally, and I said,
Yeah, that's it.
I said, what kind are you doing? Like,
I'm not doing any.
I know.
I'm the least healthy person that with brain stuff, and like,
but
I just
not the least healthy.
I'm probably not the least healthy, but I think on a scale of 1 to 10.
You mean your pre-existing conditions or your substance or
like I need to figure out how to fly without drinking. I need to figure that out. And
well,
there's
a whole program of people waiting to greet you.
AA?
I could introduce you to them.
Fuck them. That's not going to work for me.
I can't tell you how many people have said that to me, for whom it eventually did.
No, but I can totally not drink, but if I get on a plane, I have to drink. Like, panic sets in horrifically. And I wish I could just shut that off. I wish I could just be like I see people reading, like, a magazine on a plane.
I used to have fear of flying. Terrible.
Really?
Horrible. And I flew once without panic, and it all went away. And that tends to be the way fear of flying is. It tends to come on, get super intense, and then it just suddenly goes away. Yeah. And it comes on late, too. People often have no trouble flying, and then all of a sudden they do. Is that you?
No. I've always
been bad.
Yeah. When on my first flight to Philadelphia when I was a kid, I said to my mom, I was like, okay, we'll start taking off. And I go, all right, this is high enough right here. And she was like, what? And I was like, no, this is high enough. He's going higher? How high is he going? And I was like, Mom, tell him to go down. And she was like, oh, this is going to get bad.
No.
I just started getting claustrophobia.
I have a little bit of that, too.
Like, getting harnessed into stuff.
Yeah.
Like, Rachel Ray told me about it, and she was like, oh, I get claustrophobic. And
Rachel
I was like,
Ray? I was just with her on Friday. How weird.
Yeah, she gets claustrophobic. We were supposed to go scuba diving one time,
yeah.
And the helmet freaked her out. She's like, I'm not going to do it. Yeah. And I was like, and I never got claustrophobia, and then I got harnessed into something. I started getting claustrophobia scuba diving, like going underwater. I was like, oh, this is freaking me out. But then it's so funny. If I see a camera, I'm totally fine.
Isn't that weird?
Like, I start disconnecting with whatever it is, and I play for the camera.
Right.
And then I'm not me. I'm on TV. None of this is real.
Right.
And so I can scuba dive with cameras, but if it's without cameras, I'm a fucking mess.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if there's that's sort of a model for how to deal with your anxiety generally.
I don't know. Possibly.
Somehow put yourself in a different place.
Do you think that most people with addiction that comes from it stems from anxiety or OCD or something?
Well, addicts also have a lot of OCD and anxiety, and those are overlapping things. But real addiction comes from trauma. childhood traumas.
Oh, really?
Adverse childhood experiences. Yeah, yeah.
Like what kind of trauma?
Sexual abuse, physical abuse, neglect, stuff like that. And I always tell, you know, I have an aphorism. I was giving a lecture once, and I said, well, my patients always have this, and this very famous guy goes, don't say always. Because doctors have this thing, don't never say never and always. Because you never know. I mean, just things statistically aren't likely to be 100%.
Yeah.
And so I got up and given this lecture. And I go, well, you know, Dr. Siegel told me not to say always, so I'll just say it this way: 100% of my patients have a childhood trauma. And the way I see it is, if you have bad enough addiction, I treat really severe addicts.
Yeah.
And if you have bad enough addiction, you just see me, then there's 100% probability that you have trauma. So I'm not saying everyone with addiction has trauma.
Yeah.
I'm saying if you got bad addiction, bad enough you have to see me, then I can predict there'll be childhood trauma.
How closely related are like eating disorders and addictions?
The trauma triggers the eating disorder. So we used to have trifectas: cutting, addiction, eating. We used to see that a lot.
There was a point when I was in high school and I was like, cutting, I might as well try that, see if it works. Mm-hmm. Like just, but the, so eating disorders come out of trauma?
Yeah. Well, it's a little more complicated than that, but in my world, that's what I.
That was one of my biggest. It's one of my biggest concerns for my daughters is I don't ever want them to get eating disorders. Yeah.
My daughter eating disorder.
What?
My daughter's eating disorder.
Really?
Yeah. She was an ice skater, competitive ice skater. Women, you know, senior women, all this kind of stuff, and went to college and came back after 2 years and went. I've been in treatment for a year. I've been eating disorder. We were stunned. We were stunned. She hid it so well. I mean, that's part of the deal with eating disorders. They hide it.
Yeah.
And when she's told me, I was like. First, I was like, oh, shit, I felt so bad for her. I didn't want her to have anything wrong. And then at the same time, I was super grateful. I'm like, oh, my God, you went and you got treatment and you're actively engaged in treatment. That's so awesome. I'm so happy. You know, it was weird. It was like I didn't want her to be sick, but I was so glad that she knew to get treatment. People don't engage in treatment. You know what I mean? Mental health treatments, you have to engage with them. You have to participate in the treatment.
Yeah.
And people don't do that.
No.
And she was doing it and did it, and now it's like a spokesperson and stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
What was her eating disorder? Bulimia?
Bulimia, yeah.
I don't like throwing up.
Yeah, I know. It's weird. You know, we talked to her. She had a dietitian. She had coaches. And everyone was like, no, she wasn't. No way. We would have known. No, she was.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, did she, what was her trauma?
Dealing with her parents.
her dad telling her, I'm going to call the cops.
Eating disorders are a little more complicated. Right?
Yeah.
It's not explicit trauma.
So there's no way to, if I would imagine if anyone is going to have perfectly well-rounded kids, it's you, and even you get because I'm like fucking terrified that my oldest is going to get an eating disorder.
We'll the key is the treatment.
Drinking?
The treatment.
He's getting him in treatment?
Treatment, yeah.
Yeah, that's because I told you I kind of developed a little bit of an eating disorder when I was doing that weight loss
challenge. I've been prone to that kind of thing. Do I get momentum with that? Preoccupied? I was sort of traumatized as a kid, so.
Yeah?
Mm. Emotional trauma.
Do you consider yourself a workoutaholic?
Yeah, I really was at one time. Now I just
I remember, there was a I don't you look normal right now, but there was like I remember seeing you. I think right after you got diagnosed with cancer,
yeah.
And you were yoked.
Probably my weight was just up then because I get big when I gain weight.
No, you were just ripped. Mm. I mean, you're still in great shape, but like I was like, wow, you're working out pretty aggressively.
Before that, I was aggressive.
Really?
Yeah, and. But now I just like it. I mean, it's really like my meditation in a way.
Yeah.
I miss it if I don't.
What do you do?
It.
Do you go just do weights?
Lift weights, yeah.
Just lift weights?
Since I was like 15.
Really?
Mm.
That's so interesting. What do you think about hormone replacement therapy?
For men?
Yeah.
I bug my urologist all the time. And I'm like, I said, 5 years. If I have cancer for 5 years, I want you to put me on some testosterone.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah.
So what's okay to do?
It's carefully, you know, replacement, not excess. Not, you know, not supplement so much as replacement.
Yeah.
Right? I that makes sense to me. We replace women's hormones. Why not men?
So, but I always look at like Arnold Schwarzenegger. He had to use a lot of steroids.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Those guys, you have no idea what they do.
And he has no health problems.
He had aortic valve replacement, remember?
Oh, did he really?
Yeah.
Oh, you think that's from steroids?
Oh, I'm sure of it.
Really?
Yeah, I bet you.
And so, but you look at those guys and they're like, they seem to be fine.
They seem okay, and there's sort of a rational approach to it. People will argue that do that stuff, but a lot of the guys from the 70s are dead.
Oh, really?
A lot of them, yeah. So,
Wow.
There's a lot of cross addiction with steroids and stimulants. A lot.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could never, if I ever take a pill, I'm done for the day.
Yeah.
Like, I could never be one of those athletes who's taking pills like Brett Favre and playing.
No.
I would be like, ah, no, I'd be.
He's taking pills?
Well, no, that was back in the day.
What was he taking?
Vicodins. He was addicted to Vicodins.
Oh, my God.
That made me fucking fall in love with the guy. See, I always liked that kind of guy that, like, you're like, oh, he parties. Like John Daly. Oh.
He really parties.
I love him.
They tried to get him for celebrity rehab. Like,
oh, really?
Times, yeah.
Who's the one that you guys never could get that you really wanted?
I didn't really want anybody.
Really?
No, I was not involved in that. I evaluate people once they told me what they wanted to do.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's fucking crazy.
And I remember, I really can't tell you some of them because, you know, they didn't release. Technically, I'm evaluating them as a doctor.
Oh, yeah.
And it's only after they agree to do the show, they sign away all their privacy privileges. But they were so ridiculous with who they wouldn't allow on the show. People that were perfect for treatment, but because they said they were suicidal or something, like, oh, no, no, no. I'm like, look, you're not evaluating whether somebody can be on a reality show. You're evaluating whether I can treat them, whether they're appropriate for treatment. I decide that, not your bullshit little screens for whether or not somebody can tolerate being on a reality show.
Yeah.
And then they would send me people that were inappropriate for treatment. They were too sick. That used to drive me insane. And they'd go, I met with the family. They're so sweet and nice. Oh, this boy has a little problem. No, oh, you'll enjoy them. And I'm like, the guy comes and he's like dying of addiction. I'm like, oh, my God. What's the matter with these psychologists?
That's anyway. Crazy.
Yeah.
That now, what do you we should probably wrap this up. I know you got a busy day, but what do you want to do next?
I don't know.
What do you right know. Now? You've got your podcast with Bob.
Podcast with another doctor. Podcast with Adam. Podcast mm-hmm. by myself. Just a bunch of podcasts and KBC Radio here in Los Angeles.
Yeah,
and I don't know. I'm going to start something with CNN again, but I think that's going to be relatively limited. And I would kind of like to. I don't know, something about talk and panels or something new. I was talking to somebody recently about like a game show, you know, that had, you know, substance to it. Like I was sort of putting ideas together, like fake news and game. There's all kinds of stuff out there that could be interesting, you know, some new Jeopardy or I don't know what. I don't know. I'm not smart and creative enough to be able to predict what people are going to watch. I can sort of tell whether I fit in it or not.
Yeah.
So as these things come along, I just sort of look at them and evaluate if I think they're worthwhile.
We did that. Do you remember? I don't know if you remember this at all. We did a pilot for radio.
You and I did?
Yeah. Do you remember this?
Tell me.
We
did a pilot?
Yep. We did. I think you ended up doing the show with Christy Alley.
Christy Alley? What are you talking about?
I'm being dead serious.
I never met Christy Alley.
I want to say that.
Unless I'm totally losing my mind, which is possible.
So we did Loveline.
Yeah.
Like probably 10 years ago, years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were looking to find a replacement. I think Daniel Tosh auditioned for it.
Yeah, no, Joel McHale. Yeah.
Kyle Cease.
Maybe. I just remember there were a bunch of people. Yeah.
And then we did something, but you guys had already cast it.
Okay.
Stryker.
Stryker ended up doing it, yeah.
Yeah, and you already cast it. And then someone said, well, we should get you guys together. So we went in. Who was running the radio station then? Was it Norm Pattis?
Yep.
Norm Pattis came in, and me and you did an afternoon drive time audition. Like,
yes, I kind of remember this, yeah.
And so we fielded questions, and I was horrifically not the right fit. Like, because I think it was patterned towards women.
Okay.
And so we're like, all right, we got to call her.
I remember there was a period where they were trying different people with me.
Yeah.
And we tried Arthel Neville.
I don't know who that is.
No, what's her name? She used to do a CNN show. Black woman, nice, really, really sharp, nice woman. Anyway,
I thought you ended up doing it with Christy Alley. I'm not even joking.
I met Christy Alley.
And so we did the thing, and the caller was like, my husband.
It was probably fake callers, too.
It was fake callers.
That makes it the worst.
And they're like, my husband is and I are having some marital problems. We just had a baby, and you were being very clinical, and I went, how much weight did you gain? And she was like, excuse me?
Oh, my God.
It wasn't a real caller. She's like, I had no answer for it.
Yeah, I do remember this whole period where they were trying people.
Norm Pattis was behind me, and you were looking over my shoulder going like this. I was like, huh?
That, I don't think that show ever happened.
Oh, really?
Bottom line, yeah.
It was a drive time.
I did some sort of drive time AM thing by myself. But yeah. That was quickly gone, too.
Yeah. So you don't know what you want to do?
I've got a bunch of things I'm trying to produce that I'm interested in that look really interesting and like they'll make a difference. I'm interested in making a difference. I'm always interested in that.
Oh, I'm the exact opposite.
If I can create something that makes a difference, I'm in. But it has to be, you know, the conundrum for me is I know a lot of stuff make a difference. Nobody will watch. So the conundrum for me is trying to find something that does something good and people want to watch it. It's hard.
Yeah. What do you think in your career has done the most good? What's the one project you think?
There are three that I knew would have a significant impact. That was Loveline, because I already knew that was affecting people's behavior. I could tell. Teen Mom, I knew that would work. I knew that would decrease teen pregnancy. It did. And there's several academic studies now to prove that. And Celebrity Rehab. Bob and I wanted to raise awareness about how tough this thing is, how difficult treatment is, how sick people are, and how to make fun of celebrities with addiction is not funny.
Yeah.
And so
it was that show was very pivotal. Yeah. That show was very pivotal in the way that I think a lot of people looked at it brought up the conversation of like the addiction and interventions and there was that whole period where you're like,
yep, that was it, because really what people don't realize it was not public discourse.
It wasn't at all. And then that came out and everyone was talking about it.
I mean, back when we started, people was like, the addiction, why don't you just stop, man? What's the big deal? I mean, literally like didn't understand what this addiction even was.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. Well, Drew, I appreciate you coming over and doing this.
I'll do another one. That's so fun.
Yeah,
talk
this
to you all day.
Is seamless.
Did we got everything for Leanne?
I think so.
We got the
three questions from Leanne. And I just did your podcast with Bob, which is a blast.
That was fun.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was good.
It was, you like to keep yours like in an hour?
Yeah.
Mine will ramble on for three if I don't stop it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. My fans love three-hour podcasts.
Really?
Oh, love. That's why we got to get you on Rogan, me and you and Rogan.
All right. He does 3 hours, too?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Oh, yeah, yeah. Get ready to hunker down.
All right, let's do that.
Yeah, Rogan.
I would have put aside more time if I'd known.
No. I did a five-hour podcast with Rogan one time.
Oh, my God.
But it's like in all honesty, with Rogan, the conversation starts getting good at an hour and a half.
Well, people are always like, Joe Rogan thinks you're... I've known Joe forever.
Yeah, Joe doesn't have any problems with you.
I have no problem with Joe.
Joe doesn't have a problem with anyone. If Joe has a problem with you, he said it out loud. Like, he says it. He'll be like, no, I don't like that person. Like,
I think if he and I have any disagreement at all, by the way, it's a healthy disagreement, it's more on the order of the complexities of human psychology. You know, his thing is just, hey, we're just monkeys that talk. That's it. And everything's pretty, you know, sort of... almost categorizable rather than dynamic. Does that make sense? We'll find out. We'll go talk. We'll chat.
Yeah. We'll set it up. Yeah. So check out Drew and Bob. All of Drew's podcasts are all they're all over Dave's, right?
Everything's drdrew.com.
Drdrew.com.
And I'm in development for TV for the next year or two until we find. I got some interesting people that I'm trying to bring on television.
Really?
That do interesting stuff. Yeah.
Really? Psychics?
No, I've got a woman that. She's got one of the most popular Instagrams on Instagram, and she does. She's a pathology tech and teaches people about autopsies, and she's fantastic. Check out Nicole and Jemmy on Instagram, and then I've got another group of this wild group of guys and a woman that extract kids from like gangs and take them to treatment for like 2 years. Yeah, these guys are amazing, and they're interesting in themselves.
Yeah. That's where I find I'm obsessed right now with all the children. This is going to sound tacky, but like that are ignored in this country. Ugh. That like we have these. It seems like everyone's got these special interest marches and protests and Facebook and hashtags.
Yeah.
And then there's just these kids that aren't getting to see how great life can be. And I just go, shit, man, I think we should refocus. Like. You know, the most important thing is some kid is just sitting in a room by himself with mom.
One positive relationship outside the home sustained over years can change the trajectory of a child like that.
Really?
One positive relationship with an adult.
I'm just trying to raise my two to be normal.
I know.
I'm going to go have a talk with them right now about drugs. Drew, I appreciate you doing this. Right. Thank you so much. This episode was brought to you by The Machine.